Well, hello everyone. I'm going to attempt to record a lecture here. So let us hope that I don't make too many mistakes. I really think this is an important book. We talked about it in class. I don't think that Mr. Ford is right about everything, and I respect his expertise, but he does speculate a lot, so I think it's fair game to think about whether or not we really believe some of his speculations. But this bears directly upon what's happening in the economy, and some of the things he has to say are just simply they're absolutely true. And as a consequence, we have to start thinking seriously about what this means for workforce in the United States and how it may exacerbate inequality and how that's going to affect the political system going forward. It's important to realize that he's talking about computer software and robotics. So obviously software has to run on computers, but the critical thing is that computers have gotten more and more powerful, smaller in size, much faster, and that enables computers to do lots of things very quickly. Robotics depends upon advances in machine tools and electrical mechanics and other kinds of innovation that aren't necessarily driven by computers. However, industrial robots, which he focuses on first, are clearly a combination of advanced design in gearing and bearings, advanced metalwork and so forth to make something that's strong enough to actually drill holes through steel and so forth. So it's a combination of high technology as well as computing. In his introduction, I think he says it pretty well, and I'll quote it directly. Virtually, this is on page XVI, Roman numerals. Virtually every industry in existence is likely to become less labor intensive as new technology is assimilated into business models. And that transition could happen quite rapidly. At the same time, the new industries that emerge will nearly always incorporate powerful labor-saving technology right from their inception. Companies like Google and Facebook, for example, have succeeded in becoming household names and achieving massive market valuations while hiring only a tiny number of people relative to their size and influence. There's every reason to expect that a similar scenario will play out with respect to nearly all the new industries created in the future. The point is that, as we have talked about both in the polarization course and in the inequality course, what we are seeing is increasingly goods that we make in the United States have a higher and higher capital input and a lower and lower labor input. And I gave the example in class, and he uses it as well, that textile mills have returned to the United States, but they only employ a handful of people who basically are running the machines instead of the hundreds and hundreds of people that used to be employed in these textile mills all over the southern states, and at one time in New England, which back before the Civil War consumed a lot of the cotton grown in the South to make clothing and fabric. However, a lot of the cotton was exported to the textile mills in England, but nevertheless, those mills, be they in New England or in England, employed vast numbers of people, even though they managed to automate in the sense of the old weaver machines. Andrew Carnegie's father was a weaver, which at one time was a very prestigious occupation. But then as the steam-powered weaving mills moved in the 1840s, all of these folks are put out of work. So this automation is old. What he is really concerned with is automation due to the advances in computer technology. He first turns basically to, this is on slides, you see this on slides 3 to 5, to industrial robots, and he says about them that they offer an unrivaled combination of speed, precision, and brute strength. They are, for the most part, blind actors in a tightly choreographed performance. They rely primarily on precise timing and positioning. In the minority of cases where robots have machine vision capability, they can typically see in just 2 dimensions and only in controlled lighting conditions. Machine vision is something that always reminds me of the solar photovoltaic industry, namely, it's just around the corner, it's just around the corner. There's been tremendous advances in solar photovoltaic panels, but it's still the case that they're not competitive with fossil fuel. They're getting closer and closer and closer. But I've been reading story after story after story for nearly 20 years where this was just around the corner and it was going to be revolutionary. And I think it's fair to say that in the case, say, of solar panels, they have achieved great efficiencies, and they're very, very useful in climates like desert climates like Southern California and in Nevada. The state of Israel has quite a few, quite an investment of photovoltaics. But the problem is that, again, as I've discussed in class, there has not been a breakthrough in storage capacity, storage technology for electricity. And it looked like for a while that superconductivity might be the magic bullet, and they came up with very rare chemicals that could be made into basically types of wire that were super conductive, not at absolute zero, but slightly above. But that whole technology seems to have disappeared. I'm sure it's still out there, but it's been quite a few years since these breakthroughs have been made, and still we do not have reliable storage technology for the production of electricity. In other words, if we're going to have solar power replace natural gas-fired plants, which are already replacing coal-fired plants. We have to have a reliable method of storage, and we don't have that yet. So that's the same problem with computer vision, that the claim is that it's getting better and better and better, but it's still not the case that computers are very good at this. If you look directly at a camera, then a computer can crank and grind and identify you. But if your head is turned one way or the other, it proves to be increasingly difficult. Furthermore, there was a very interesting article that I know I told one of the classes about, and that's why I need Sarah there every day. In the New Yorker, a recent New Yorker, about the discovery of human beings that are what the London police officer who was in charge of this unit called super recognizers. And it turns out that human beings vary greatly in their ability to recognize faces in a variety of contexts. And this has nothing to do with IQ or gender. It's some odd talent that is hardwired in some individuals and not in others. And what this police officer did in London, which has the most cameras of any place in the world, basically monitoring almost every street and subway stop and bus stop. The problem is that you can't, basically, if somebody commits a crime, then it's very difficult to catch that person, even if you know. And then I gave the example in the New Yorker is of this creep that would get on a bus or a subway and grope a woman. He would sit next to a woman, he'd grope her, then he'd quickly get off. So they had a rough description of him, and with the timing of these assaults, they were able to locate a picture of this individual on a variety of these closed circuit TVs. Then it became a problem, how on earth do you know where this person is? And it turned out that this unit of super recognizers, this woman who had this capability, remarkable, they figured out roughly the radius where the guy had to live, and so they had video of people coming out of subway exits, like, say, for example, if you've been in New York City in Manhattan, and you know to get to the subway, there are all sorts of places you can get down that come out at street level. And this woman was watching film, and bang, she recognized the guy in a crowd. They were then able, through some really clever detective work, figure out where the person lived and made the arrest. In this article, the author discusses machine vision. And she does a really good job of pointing out that a lot of this machine vision is totally illusory, in that you can train one of these robots by showing image after image after image, but then if they're given basically a different point of view, they don't work as well. So machine vision has a long way to go before it is practical, despite the discussion in this book. Here's some more examples of slide 4 shows robots that are working in a bakery, moving pallets around. Slide 5 is something that he discusses very early on with regards to an Amazon warehouse, where basically robots are able to, with human beings standing nearby, basically get boxes off the top of big, in fact, you can see it in the center picture in slide 5, off the top of a big stack like you might see in Sam's Club, and bring it down, and the human worker then can put it on some sort of pallet or whatever to be basically shipped to the customer who's ordered whatever this thing was, because Amazon basically you can buy anything on Amazon these days. Now, industrial robots are really very simple devices, and I think he's right basically that it's already happened, that as long ago as the 70s, and for example in auto manufacturing, some of these dangerous things like painting the chassis of automobiles, or dipping them into vats, very toxic chemicals, those were automated a long time ago. And welding machines were also turned over to robots a long time ago. So that this technology, I think, is fairly mature, is bound to get better as we make more advances in gearing. And as you can see from some of these pictures, these are pretty complex devices that are used in many of these manufacturing plants. It then turns to discussion of essentially what's going on now, and really closely parallels, this is chapter 3 of his book, and he titles it, interestingly enough, Is This Time Different?, which is a famous book that came out a few years ago about financial crises, where every time you have a financial crisis, the people in the financial crisis, whatever the country is, or usually the international financial crises, they think, well, this time is different, it's unique in some sense. And there have been people who've argued with the data in that book, but it still, I think, holds up pretty well. And for example, this book forecasts that when you have a serious meltdown like we had in the financial sector between 2006 into early 2009, the Great Recession, that the recovery from something like that is much, much longer than if you have, say, an ordinary, in quotes, recession as occurred, for example, Bush the first, right at the beginning of his administration, when the economy had started to slow down in late 2000, and we had a minor recession in 2001, but we came out of it fairly quickly. So this is a play off of that, off of that title, I am sure, deliberately. And he talks, basically, what he's doing with this chapter is talking about basically the trends that are now occurring, many of which I've talked about in some depth, especially in the inequality course, about the introduction of computers beginning in the 70s, when what we used to call big iron, like the IBM 360, 65, and other large computers became practical and began to be used by banks and other companies. And what we see, and with the introduction of this, and this is shown slide 6, which is also one that I've shown in this very famous graph that if you go on Google, you'll find it in just a huge variety of contexts. And that is right around, he shows it diverging something around 73. I think the one I had in class showed it diverging about 1976 or 73 to 76. And that is, before that, real productivity as it went up was matched by real compensation. In other words, as the productivity increased in, say, a firm like United States Steel or Ford Motors or General Electric, the old style heavy industries, as productivity increased, workers basically were able to capture their share of that in proportion. And so real compensation rose in lockstep with productivity. And the big mystery is why that stopped in the 1970s. And again, recall that the bottom 40% of the income distributions, the bottom two quintiles, basically a flatline since 1976. That is, in real dollars since 1976, the bottom 40%, and more likely about 50% of the population in the United States has not seen their real income increase. And again, this goes a long way in accounting for the high level of dissatisfaction in the country. And as I've talked repeatedly about, all of these social problems like drug addiction that we're beginning to see pop up that had seemed to decline, during the good times, during the Reagan-Clinton boom. Now, he takes economists to task for not really recognizing this, including, of all people, Ben Bernanke, who has an economics textbook. And I think it's fair to say that the economists have been resistant to this. It's something that flies in the face of old-style smokestack America economy, but it's understandable when you think about the introduction of computer technology widely in large businesses, the financial industry, banks, etc. And it was disguised for a long time by movement of people into the service sector and increasing levels of education, but it's now gotten to the point where it's very clear that this is eating away at the social fabric of the country and increasingly causing ripple effects in the political system. In slide 7, I didn't show a figure quite like this in class, but this essentially fits with the slide 6 in that this is again from the Federal Reserve Bank, St. Louis. They are a very good source of all sorts of economic indicators because Federal Reserve Banks employ professional economists, and it's actually a fairly prestigious place to work, so that Federal Reserve Banks in general attract really bright economists who do a lot of hard work gathering macroeconomic data. And so if you ever want to find something on long-term unemployment trends and so forth, this is a good place to start. Point here is that this is the labor's share of national income, which is another way of saying, capital input versus labor input, what's the labor share of the entire real income of the American economy. So you notice it's very high at the beginning in the 1950s and into the 60s, when basically the United States was a closed economy after World War II, because Europe was devastated, so was Japan. The Soviet Union basically closed off Eastern Europe, so that the United States did not have any, and because the United States did not suffer bombing or destruction of its industrial base after a short recession after the end of the Second World War, the big factories like Ford Motors and General Motors and others that had been converted to war production, reconverted to manufacturing automobiles and consumer goods. And this was a period when basically the steel industry didn't have any competition, so that the United Steelworkers and the big steel corporations, basically, since they didn't have any competition from overseas, after a bit of a conflict with President Truman during the Korean War, what you see in the steel industry for a very long time is basically the United Steelworkers and the steel industry, manufacturers of steel, just basically had these deals that paid very high wages, and the unions just basically agreed not to strike for some period of time. So as a consequence, steelworkers made such a good living. This, you go up and look at an ex-steel town like Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that the steelworkers made good enough money that all their children were sent to college. And that's one of the reasons why you see this tremendous immigration out of some of these northern manufacturing cities, because the young people got college educations and moved away. But notice that you get this dip in the 60s, and then it kind of climbs up. It looks like it's okay. That is labor share. Again, I'm looking at slide 7. And then notice, in step with slide 6 on the productivity and income, you can see, if you basically drew a line with a ruler here, that you see this dropping off. Let's stop at, say, in the early 90s, where it's fallen down. He doesn't have these grid lines very well marked, but you can see it's fallen down a bit, and then there's a recovery during the Clinton boom, in the 2000s, probably due to the high-tech sector, and which required much more highly educated workers, then notice the crash. Beginning in the early 2000s, basically the labor share just goes down and down and down. It recovered slightly there right before the Great Recession, and then as of 2014 it stood at 58% versus 65% at the beginning. So again, this is evidence that something is going on, namely that the labor share of the economy is falling. And at the same time, and this is a criticism made mostly by Democrats, but they are correct in my view about this, as I have stated in class, and you find it in the Stiglitz book, and it's discussed also in Polarized America for the students in the polarization course. One of the interesting things that's occurred is that corporate compensation, that is for top officers, has just climbed through the stratosphere. You can see the dip there during the meltdown between late 2006 and 2009, and then it nicely recovered. There's a lot of explanations for this, but I think the simplest one basically is that boards of directors just simply have failed to curb corporate compensation and corporate, that is, of say chief executive officers, the COOs, those folks who are in charge of the financial part of the business, and other top executives basically are given these compensation packages that aren't tied to the actual performance of the corporation, and they're also given all these stock options that they can use that they can cash in, although that's been curbed a bit under President Obama, but it's still the case that CEO compensation is just simply out of control relative to what it was in the past, as you can see when you take a look at, say, the period. It was high for a while there right after the Second World War, which makes sense because all of those corporations like the big auto manufacturers had to be retooled, and so that was a very complex task that these corporate leaders had to undertake. And then notice it's pretty stable through the period of the closed economy, and it goes down during the 80s and then explodes after 2000. So that they're led by Elizabeth Warren and other critics, there is a very good case to be made for reforming this system. I think it would take, though, changes in the corporate tax structure, which is way out of line with all the rest of the industrialized economies in Europe and in Japan, in order to do something about this. But you can see that corporations haven't been suffering, and compensation basically is tied directly to the profits. The other worrisome trend here, although the latest report that just came out wasn't too bad, it showed, I believe, a a slight uptick in the labor force participation rate. But in general, the labor force participation rate has been falling since it peaked in the during the Clinton boom in the 1990s. Partly this is due to people like myself, the baby boom generation. I'm age 69, and I'm sure that you suffering students probably would be happy if the Georgia university system would actually do buyouts of some senior professors. But I wouldn't hold your breath waiting for that to happen. So the labor participation rate has gone down partly because of the aging of the population, namely my generation. Although you can't make too much of this because we've had a very large amount of immigration into the United States, and these folks, mainly from Mexico, but also Central America, China, these folks tend to have more children, so that, and our, although fertility in the United States fell during the Great Recession, before the Great Recession, we were very close to our replacement rate, which is 2.1. So that even though the participation rate has fallen, we are not in the same conundrum that Japan is in, which does not allow any immigration whatsoever, and the population is getting very old in Japan, and they are in deep trouble. Not only has their economy been mired in a recession since 1991, but their population is rapidly aging and needs more social services, yet they don't have a young enough population of workers, and the fertility rate's low to take care of the problem. So I'm not sure exactly what's going to happen with Japan. This is slide 10, and this is a devastating slide. Notice that the last one that says zero, this is for 2010, and also that, notice the bar that's 2000 to 7, that's prior to the Great Recession. So the Great Recession, basically, if you just stop at 2010, destroyed so many jobs that the net effect from 2000 to 2010 is zero. But this is a very worrisome slide because, again, the job creation has fell from the 60s to 70s. It, again, during the Reagan-Clinton boom, and I call it the Reagan-Clinton boom because the economy took off in 1983 and only flattened out for a brief period of time under Bush the first, and then took off again under President Clinton, which is again why President Clinton is still so popular and beloved by the American people, and why a very large majority of the public felt that the impeachment of President Clinton was wrong, and we didn't need to know the unsavory details. But in any event, from the 1990s, basically we've fallen off a cliff in job creation. And again, that fits with all these other trends. And here is something that is related to that book, This Time is Different. although this is again a little bit, well, in any event, it took the months for employment to recover from the start of the recession. He has it about 80 months. The unemployment that came out just a few days ago was at 5%, I believe, and which was good news. It's not bad. I mean, you know, you can't, you know, begrudge that. It's again one of the reasons why President Obama's popularity is up. The 2001 recession was not a financial meltdown. That was a kind of a standard recession, but what it was though was the implosion of the dot-com boom. I'll never forget a conference that we had at the business school where I spent 19 years sometime in the 1990s, where one of the speakers confidently predicted that all brick and mortar retailing would go away and it would all be online. And remember, there was a website that web startup that would deliver pet food to your house and deliver groceries to your house and so forth, and all of those cratered, and the dot-com boom blew up. And that's part of that recession that occurred early in the Bush years. It really started in 2001. The 81-82, that was the very, very sharp recession under early Reagan administration. Actually, there was a double dip recession in there that occurred in the latter years of the Carter administration. But that's when Paul Volcker was the head of the Federal Reserve, was determined to wring what was then known as stagflation out of the economy. That is simultaneous high inflation rate and high interest rates. And for example, mortgage rates in the late 70s under President Carter were, you know, on the order of 10 to 12%. And my wife and I, our first house in Eugene, Oregon, we felt lucky we got a loan at a 12% interest rate. Now housing, if you do a 30-year fixed mortgage, depends on if you have the 20% down, you can get under 4%. So that shows you the change that occurred after Volcker basically wrung this out of the economy. And that set the stage for this dramatic recovery that occurred from 1983 up to really 89-90. And the Bush recession was pretty short, which is why I'm not quite sure that 30 months is right, but, you know, I won't argue with it that much, because the economy took off under President Clinton about 1993 and just kept going, growing and going and going. And again, that's why people thought the impeachment was stupid, for the simple reason that here's this, you know, the economy was great. What are the Republicans doing to themselves? This is a percentage of U.S. workers in manufacturing. And again, the United States manufactures almost as much as it used to, but with far less labor input than before. And as a consequence, again, that's the story of why textile mills are coming back to the United States is that they're so automated that they can be run by a fraction of the workers that used to run the old textile mills. So as a consequence, manufacturing employment has really fallen off dramatically. That basically, you know, he doesn't really show any more graphs along these lines. He then turns to a discussion basically of information technology. And here, what I want to talk about and is essentially the tremendous innovation in, I think, his best example here is IBM's Watson. IBM's Watson. And so let me take a pause here in the recording, if I can figure out how to do that. And I'll resume just in a second. All right, let's resume. Since I'm already up to about 45 minutes, I'll cover what I think is the remaining important material here. Many of you know that IBM basically built a computer they started working on it in probably the late 80s, early 90s, when I was at Carnegie Mellon, which had a only MIT, perhaps, or Caltech, perhaps, had better robotics than Carnegie Mellon. Had a robotic institute, which was world class. So they were also very advanced in their use of computing technology. Chess has always been a real challenge for trying to build a chess computer, because even though if you've had, say, Keith Doherty's game theory class, chess technically is a game that has an unbelievable number of possible outcomes, but there must exist a perfect way of playing that game. So we all know how to win a tic-tac-toe, and chess is a game where there must exist basically a winning, if you're white, a winning game that you could always play. So this has always challenged computer folks, and in fact, early on during the DOS days in the 80s, there were, you know, some reasonably decent chess computers. A lot of those just stored most of the standard openings, like the Ruy Lopez and so forth. And, you know, you could set them to some level and play against them to see if you could beat them. But what IBM came up with is, and I believe some of this development was done at Carnegie Mellon, is that they basically came up with the idea of having each square essentially have its own processor. And then they link these processors together, and so if you were playing against this computer, the thing was designed basically brute force. It would search down the game tree for the best possible response, and because it had a processor for each square on the board and very sophisticated software that linked those together, They could search basically millions and millions of possible moves against you in a very, you know, very quickly. So this thing got better and better and better, and finally in 1996, Garry Kasparov, who is now one of Putin's leading critics, and surprisingly Putin hasn't put a hit out on him yet, he ran for president against Putin and basically was blocked from doing so. But Kasparov was a world champion at that time, and he played Deep Blue in 1996 and lost. I think it was 4-2. And then the next year they played under traditional tournament conditions, and Deep Blue won 3.5-2.5. So we've had chess playing computers now since the 1990s that have this capability. I think they're barred from international competition for obvious reasons. But this led IBM in the early 2000s, and this is a story that's told really well in Rise of the Robots in Chapter 4, where they came up with the idea of, why don't we see if we can build a computer that can win at Jeopardy, which was a completely different kind of problem. And in fact, IBM worked on for a very long time. They quickly figured out that they couldn't use Deep Blue to win at Jeopardy, because Jeopardy, basically, as you know, you get the answer and then you have to state your response and, you know, what is Mount Everest or something like that. So you had to have a computer that could handle natural language, namely you would have to read listen to the clue, the answer rather, and then you would have to take that and somehow figure out the response. And this required a whole new approach to computing problems. And this is what I think is going to be extremely revolutionary. Leading lights in artificial intelligence have weighed in and stated that IBM Watson is not artificial intelligence, and I agree with that. We're not likely to see IBM Watson and its progeny, you know, basically Skynet, you know, taking over. But it's an extraordinary system, and again, it relies basically on speed. It's not a neural net computer. I'm not sure exactly how many processors they use, but it's a lot. But the real breakthrough here was basically figuring out the algorithms to get them to the question. So, I'm sorry, the answer rather. So that you basically, the question is asked, and so you've got to parse that question into a form that the computer can use to then search for the answer. So that one of the things they did is that they loaded this system with basically all the past, I forget, 20 years or more, Jeopardy answers. Plus they put in, I believe, so many newspapers have been digitized. They put all of that in. They put in basically encyclopedias, almost any information source that has been digitized and can be stored. So basically the idea here is that they basically came up with these clever algorithms that would parse, you know, the clue and then use the words. Sometimes these, you know, clues are strange. They would then use the words to essentially search through these vast databases. So that this is from here on slide 15 is a block diagram of the basic idea here. Namely, they would take the question, they take the question and they decompose it basically into the keywords in the question, and they use that to kind of form of what they call hypothesis generation. Then they'd search through this vast database for, say, the co-occurrence of certain words, and they would get a significant number of hits. And then that would go back down, and then they would basically filter that and go through yet another step of, you know, they would assign points to the possible answers that they find in these vast databases, and they would do another search to basically see if they can confirm that it made sense, that this synthesis step. And they would then basically do a final ranking and then hit the buzzer. They'd hit the buzzer. And this very, very sophisticated system turned out, you know, to work very well. I forget what date this is, but then this is not that far long ago. I believe around, I think they did this around 2009 or 2010, is that two of the biggest champions won against Watson. And Watson won. In other words, it managed to hit the buzzer first, and this is a picture of Watson winning. This is a real breakthrough, and was a real breakthrough, an extraordinary example of what you could do with these, what I call syntactic engines, namely the parsers of a sentence that then could search vast databases and come up with an answer. But it is brute force. Although it's very sophisticated because they had to write so many algorithms to do it. But it's not true artificial intelligence. But they then have gone on, and this is where I think this is why I'm ignoring some of the rest of the book, because I think it's kind of silly. This is where they've gone on. They went to the MD Anderson Cancer Center, which is the leading institute in the world that treats cancer. And it's in the great city of Houston, where I spent 4 years of my career as the Kenneth L. Lay Professor of the Political Science for Social Sciences. And that's the Kenneth L. Lay of the Enron meltdown. And they've used the same architecture, only what they've done is that they've they've adapted it by putting in every imaginable patient record that, you know, is obviously you don't identify the individual, but you have demographics, patient record, and every imaginable symptom and all of the information that's been gathered over many, many years about cancers and how they manifest themselves and what oddball things they do. And this has turned out to be a highly successful tool. And this really is very recent, so that we're only beginning to see the leading edge of what is possible using these big database machines, namely that basically swallow up vast amounts of information, and then because computers keep getting faster, you can search these databases very, very fast using intelligent keyword algorithms and find things that you didn't know. And he gives an example of somebody who had this illness that was finally discovered by the use of Watson, the applied in this cancer thing. He does a lot of speculation in the rest of the book, which I am going to skip because I think it's somewhat beside the point, because I think that we're way far away from robots, like in the famous iRobot movie with Will Smith, and then there was another one, I forget, Ex Machina, something of that nature. And actually there was an old Star Trek episode about this, where trying to create a real walking, talking robot, and we're nowhere close to that, not even close. And again, facial recognition is extremely difficult. Recognition of voices is better, but that's simply because, again, brute force computing, what these voice recognition systems do, that when you call in and you talk to a damn robot instead of a person at all these companies, those are all brute force. Namely, they take about every possible pronunciation of a specific word, like bill me, and they essentially take the sound waves and they store these things. And so when they ask you to state something clearly, what it is just searching and doing a pattern match with a sound wave of your voice that's coming over the telephone with their database, and then this nice pleasant computer voice, tells you, well, sorry, and hangs up, whatever. That's the VA, actually. In any event, it's very clear that just this Watson technology and these industrial robots and the algorithms that have been developed basically to do routine kinds of tasks in the financial industry and many other industries are going to displace more and more and more workers in the economy and make the economy more and more capital intensive. He's a bit alarmist in that at the end of the book he advocates for, what are we going to do with everybody that's unemployed and sitting around, and basically advocates a wealth tax and a guaranteed income. I don't think we're quite there yet, but there's actually absolutely no question when you look at the inequality data and again at its high correlation with the introduction of computing, with computing largely computing and robotics, we have not yet dealt with this. And again, as unemployment is people are forced downward in the income distribution. As I've stated in both classes, this is only going to create more social problems and start to really affect our political system. And you can see that in the rise of Trump this year, and things are not going to improve anytime soon in that regard. So that we need desperately innovation that allows us to get ahead of this job-destroying computer technology, but again, with the private industry reducing its research and development, and research and development seemingly frozen in the federal government, this presents your generation with a very thorny set of problems, and the future in that sense is very uncertain. So with that, I will sign off, and I will see you on Friday.